Today on Wings.
There are wonderful documents that come out of the UN and out of UN conferences. They're wonderful. If they were only implemented, the world would be a better place.
20 years ago in Beijing, United Nations members unanimously adopted a set of promises for women's advancement. What institutional mechanisms do governments have to fulfill these promises? And what keeps them from doing a better job? That is the topic on Wings today.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, I'm Frieda Worden, series producer of Wings. Last fall, I attended a forum in Geneva where a lot of passionate women compared notes and advised the UN about meeting obligations to women. Here are highlights from a 90-minute panel I recorded titled Institutional Mechanisms. Here's the panel's moderator.
My name is Erika Kvapilova. I am a UN Women representative in Georgia, and before I served as a program director of UN Women in Southeastern Europe, and it's a privilege to moderate this important panel. Yesterday I got a very provocative question from a young participant of this gathering, who probably at the time of the Beijing conference was something like 7 or 8 years old. And she asked me the question, how we can expect the gender machineries to function effectively within the central structures that do not deliver in many other areas? I think she was talking about governments, right? So this question is provocative, and traditional answers to these problems, like we need more political commitment, or we need, I don't know, more funding, or we need just to implement. These are self-evident, but maybe they are not sufficient. Certainly they were not sufficient for me to answer the question of a young feminist who is participating in this meeting. But we have great panelists who will provide their analysis what's going wrong with gender equality mechanisms in many countries, which are underfunded, undercapacitated, not placed at the right place. And we are looking forward to hearing also their recommendations.
That was the panel's moderator, Erika Kvapilova, who is a UN representative in the Eastern European state of Georgia. The first panelist was Jean Shinoda Bolin, a Jungian psychoanalyst from the United States.
There are wonderful documents that come out of the UN and out of UN conferences. They're wonderful. If they were only implemented, the world would be a better place. And they're not being implemented. And as the state of the world gets more and more dire, they become less and less important. Unless we do a top-down and bottom-up movement to implement that which really matters to women. And if it matters to women, it matters to children. If it matters to children, it'll affect the planet as well. So the premise I speak from is that the best way to implement the documents we have and also to create new documents is to support the Secretary General and the President of the General Assembly's statement on International Women's Day in 2012. And they said it is high time we had another women's conference. And that resolution just went nowhere. It was discussed in the General Assembly, but it was not passed by the General Assembly. It wasn't taken up, but it wasn't taken off the table either. So my premise is that the only way this will happen is if you, bring out of the regional conferences recommendations that go up the ladder to support the idea of a fifth Women's World Conference. And the way things work at the UN is if we could have them pass this in the current General Assembly, 2014, 2015, we could have one at the earliest at 2018. Now, in 2018, many of you who were at the previous conferences will still be around, I hope. And there will also be a whole generation of globally minded millennials who are old enough, connected enough on the internet. You know, in 1995 at Beijing, we weren't on the internet. Some people were, but they were the techies and the nerds. It wasn't every day all of us. Now it is. And young women are very good at doing the internet. And if you can imagine young women who are concerned with causes, have a passion, connecting with other women in other countries, and meeting online first, and then planning to meet at a conference. And we are also, as an advocate for this, looking at New Delhi and India as the host country. So it's two-pronged effort. One is to work at the UN level to get a resolution passed. The other is that if the new government of India would offer to be the host country, it would pass. When the new government of India came into office, the new prime minister, in his very first important talk, he was speaking from the Red Fort on Independence Day for India, and he started out with the necessity to stop violence against women and the shame that India had a rape culture. Well, Ban Ki-moon, when he entered office as the Secretary General and started UNITE, his first emphasis is on stop violence against women as well. Because if you address violence against women, you actually do address all of the inequities down the line. Well, in 2012, we saw sociological research in considerable depth was done. It was 40 years of research from 1975 to 2010. And it covered 70 countries, and it surmised that it didn't matter how many women were in parliament, whether it was a liberal government, it didn't matter whether it was a third world developing country or a first world country, the only thing that made a difference on implementing issues that were important to women was a strong women or feminist movement on the ground. And recently in India, we saw what happened. Women demonstrated because rape laws that are on the books were not being enforced, and they took to the streets and protested, and lo and behold, rape laws are being implemented. It's a wonderful example, and that is one of the reasons for the idea of a Fifth Women's World Conference. And the other reason is how it is that women bond and become allies. Really, it is because through friendships, through face-to-face, through connections, through sharing lives together, we become friends. And that is the basis of what I call heart-connected activism, that we have a passion for something, we make allies that are moving in the same direction, sharing values, motivated by love.
Jean Shinoda Bolen, making the point that women from around the world meeting each other and becoming allies is an even more important reason for holding world conferences on women than the documents that governments sign there.
My question is how can we genuinely stand on the platform, the Beijing platform for action, and step up, even if it means we need walkers and ramps to get to it?
The Beijing Platform for Action is the document that came out of the last UN World Conference on Women in 1995. One of its critical areas of concern was institutional mechanisms, and that is the topic of this panel. This speaker is Annette Lawson from the UK's National Alliance of Women's Organizations.
I'm wanting to talk about this in the context of something we all share, which is the global recession and the fact that we have a neoliberal economic system that is broadly accepted, and that has led in the UK, as it has in many, many other countries, to the idea that you have to cut expenditure, especially on welfare and services, and not raise taxes for that kind of money in order to reduce the deficit. And we also have, in common with many other countries within the ECE, a rightist government. I wouldn't say they're right-wing. Compared to others I could mention, they're not right-wing, but they are right of center, and they follow policies which aren't, generally speaking, terribly interested in social justice, including not social justice as it relates to the women's and feminist agenda. But however, we do have powerful women on the right as well as on the left, including at cabinet level in the UK government, who do speak out aloud about things that we all would share in wanting, including especially getting rid of violence against women and girls. It's interesting how that actually attracts so much attention from men, even though they are the major perpetrators, and I think they need to look at themselves rather more often than they do at us. However, within this recession in the UK, decisions that focus on reducing the deficit have also led to actually ones that reduce the mechanisms that there are, the machineries that there are within government. However, I want to make the point that the UK is extremely fortunate in having a government that does accept NGOs, does listen to us to some extent. I know that in the region there are governments that think NGOs are spies, don't listen to them, don't respect them. And one of my recommendations from here is that we need to make that point within the ECE, that we want all ECE governments to recognise NGOs and sometimes resource them, not completely because they need to stay independent, but resource them a bit anyway.
One moment, please. I'm going to interrupt Annette Lawson to interpret four acronyms that everyone in the room where she's speaking knows, but radio listeners may not know. NGOs are non-governmental organizations. The ECE is a UN-recognized region comprised of Europe and a hodgepodge of other developed countries. All speakers on this panel are from the ECE. In a moment, Lawson is going to mention CSW, the UN Commission on the Status of Women, and CEDAW, a treaty almost all the world's countries have ratified, agreeing to eliminate discrimination against women. The CSW evaluates countries' compliance with CEDAW, and they accept reports from NGOs to help with evaluation. Now back to Annette Lawson, chair of the UK's National Alliance of Women's Organizations.
So we have retained a national machinery. We do have ministers appointed at quite high level together with junior ministers. We have an interministerial committee on equalities, not just gender, which is always a problem. We have a gender directors network, which brings people from the four nations together, which has recently been focusing on CEDAW. And we do have a focal department, which is called the Gender Equalities Office. That, too, has had its resources cut. And the worst thing that I want to talk about is the difficulty that we're all experiencing in having the national mechanism that we used to have, which was called the Women's National Commission, and was set up in response to a request from the UN that women's voices needed to be heeded and heard back in 1969. That organization was abolished by our present government 41 years after it was set up. And the effect of that has been a fragmentation of the women's movement, and a disappearance of any kind of legitimated and resource body that can bring women's organizations, because it was about informed women was the phrase, together to develop policy and take that to government. And that's what has been extremely serious. But what I want to point out is that, as we know, women are resourceful. We are resourceful. So we kind of came into this organization, the new machinery that we had, and we said we have to do something about this. And luckily, we have CSW. Somebody in their speeches yesterday said, CSW is terribly important. I think it was our friend from Turkey over there, Selma. She said CSW is terribly important, and it is. And so we brought together from around the UK women's organizations to focus on what happens at CSW. And that organization, that big alliance, it's now more than 100 organizations, has been accepted by government as the body that they listen to, at least around CSW. And we go there and we nominate who will speak to them, who will deal with the negotiations at CSW and come out, therefore, with policy and text that we can put to them and that we really want. And they listen. And we actually have a very good partnership. But it's not necessarily recognized by everyone else, and it's quite focused. I am very proud of it. I do think it's a huge achievement. But problems are, for instance, how do we in the women's movement deal with the differences that we have between us about the policies we want to see? It's all quite difficult. So I'm going to give my recommendations, right? The first area is how do we get what we want that's going to produce us the information that will actually be able to be politicized. So it's no good saying we want gender disaggregated stuff. They might very well produce all kinds of data which are useless to our cause. So the first thing I'm going to say is we do want gender disaggregated data, and we want it disaggregated by age in cohorts. I learnt that from the Older Women's Caucus this morning, because they usually end at 65 or 75, and now we have women living to 100, and we're very different kinds of people after 65. If we did that, and we also went back to something that we used to have and don't anymore, which is gender disaggregated by marital status, it would throw into relief all those little girls who are being married off at ridiculously young ages around the world. It would throw into relief who's a widow and what experiences they are having around the world which differ from other women's, especially in situations of conflict both within states and across states. If we don't put marital status back in, we're not going to know anything about divorced people, women or men, and how they live. So we do need these things. We do have to use the mechanisms that are out there. Then, final word, we are looking for transformation. So we do not, personally, we do not want women to become the same as men. It's not that kind of equality. It is a transformative agenda, and we have to find ways of getting there, and one of them, and the most important, is voice. I'm absolutely with Jean on this, and with other people who've talked in the room, like the young woman from over there. We have it on the web. Look at all those sites all the young feminists have set up. There are dozens of them. What we haven't done is bring them back together into a collective, and that's the next step for us.
That was Annette Lawson from the National Alliance of Women's Organizations in the UK. We now come to Kathleen Leahy. She's a law professor at Queen's University in Canada. Her presentation, which was very well received, relates to the young woman's question about why expect governments to do a good job of women's advancement when they're not doing other things well either. Leahy traces the problem to the worldwide trend of tax reduction, meaning less money in hand for government programs.
My first point is that the Platform for Action is absolutely crystal clear. It calls for every aspect of tax, secret tax, replacement for tax type mechanisms to be subject to gender-based analysis and gender mainstreaming. There is absolutely no ambiguity about that whatsoever. However, in 1995, when these promises were made by all of our governments, the tax systems of the world had already come under severe attack and were under considerable, inconsiderable disarray as these promises were made. I want to start immediately by going through a series of slides that illustrate what we were up against in 1995 and what we're up against today. This is a series of slides from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, which is the richest countries in the world, containing the EU countries, US, Canada, and other highly industrialized rich countries. In other words, it is the group of countries that has the most power in the ECE region. This is the state of tax change in the decade between 1965 and 1975. The bulge out to the right is good. It shows that countries were increasing their tax bases. They were getting more tax revenues. They were using them to invest in social and community resources, human capital formation, and so on. Now we see what has happened since then, and if it looks like the tax systems of the ECE or the EU or the OECD have been on a diet, that would be a good way to put it. Note the shrinkage, the little pop out to the left. That is a couple of countries that have decided to start cutting their taxes. Everyone above on the right, the tax system growth profiles are smaller. Next decade, which takes us up from 1965 to 1995. That process had continued for two decades already by then, by 1995. The bulge on the right is small. It's nearly only half the countries. The bulge on the left is the countries that have been cutting their tax systems to the point where they had less revenues than they did in 1965. Smaller tax systems. Now we look at what has happened since 1995, when tax cutting got really underway. The bulge on the right is now getting hollowed out. The bulge on the bottom is growing. 2 years later, 2009, more tax cuts growing on the bottom. And now, 2011, the most recent, skinny on the top and bigger on the bottom. This is where the money has gone that should have been devoted to building institutional mechanisms for the advancement of women. This is why these mechanisms are underfunded, often outsourced, and starved of the resources that they need. So all the voice in the world can't fix this situation until we go right to the inside, to the heart of the problem. So we can try to work from the top down, from the bottom up, from the margins to the side, but until we go to the center and pull it out and look at it and say, this is where things have gone wrong for women and for children and for everyone, for the planet, we cannot do anything. How serious is this? This is a table that illustrates what you can go back and do in your own country. Take a look at the OECD tax ratios. I will tell you how to find them. That's the yellow line for Canada, the little sort of trail of gold, if you like. See how it falls from 1995. This is the tax cuts that have been made in Canada since 1995. 5.5% of its GDP, between $100 billion and $260 billion of revenue per year, gone away. Where did the taxes go? They went to corporations. They went to tax havens. They went to rich people. They went to secret accounts that people don't know anything about. They flow out every second of every day through hidden tax expenditures that keep grinding the wheel that drives the growth of the gap between the richest in the world and the poorest. What has this done for sex equality in Canada? Canada, you may have heard, was once the world leader in gender equality. It was rated number one in the UN from 1995 through 1999. In 2000, when the tax cutting in Canada began in even more earnest than before, you see that women struggled to hang on to equality, worked harder, got more degrees, got more paid work, did more unpaid work, etc. And this is what women have gotten for it today. It doesn't look any different in 2014 than it did in 1995, these percentages. What can we do about this? Is the big question. What is at the heart of the problem is detaxation, cuts to any and every type of tax that there is. Where there are taxes left, there are things called tax expenditures. Those are the special little tax gifts to all the people who are doing the things that governments like. The most important of which is governments really like joint tax measures, and I'm not just talking about joint filing or income splitting. It's every family-related provision that ties the size of a benefit to the degree of unpaid work that a woman can be induced to perform. Why do governments like this? Because their male voters and power holders love it, and because it cuts the costs for capitalists, for corporations, for employers, etc. We know where things have gone wrong. There is now a vast literature that feminists have generated on how these tax cuts have taken place, and we have the recipe that solves the problem. Taxing for sex equality and structural sex equality measures work. Restore progressive taxation to appropriate levels. reinstate anti-discrimination laws, give power to women. How do we do this? I would put to you that we are at a crisis point, and the crisis point is taxes are the lifeblood of any state. What we are doing with our taxes is like telling parents that they should give their children blood donation transfusions to other people every day to get money to feed their children food. We are literally consuming our own human capital to deal with the tax cut situations that have been produced. If this continues for too much longer, there will be nothing left on the planet but extremely rich people and a very, very large number of poor people, the majority of which are, as we know, women. It is time to make a political demand, take back our budgets, and on International Women's Day 2015, demand not bread and roses, but bread and taxes.
Thank you so much. I just wanted more. Thank you. I think this was really brilliant and very unexpected for me, actually, analysis of how the gender equality mechanisms are underfunded. But I think to show the time span, what actually has happened in different countries, it's extremely, I wouldn't call it refreshing, but, you know, awakening. Thank you very much for your presentation, and I am sure there will be questions and comments related to tax policies and their impact on underfunded gender equality mechanisms.
During the discussion period, several women talked about dismantling of gender equality mechanisms in their countries by new right-wing governments or due to European Union rules. Also mentioned were shifts in tax policy that cut taxes on the rich but increase sales tax and fee burdens on the poor. Kathleen Leahy, however, interjected a note of hope.
We are at a tipping point. You may not have noticed it, but on October 16th, UN Women published one of the most important studies that has ever been published in the history of womankind, a report that drew the tax issues, the economic issues, and the gender equality issues through three other pillars of sustainable societies, which are social equality, environmental progress, and economic stability, and put gender at the center of each of those, and put taxation at the center of gender equality. Go read that UN Women report. You may not have noticed it, but getting to the heart of equality is actually on the world agenda. Oxfam, tax justice, the OECD, the IMF, the World Bank, they've all got the same kinds of papers out there. But right now, it's more in print and in words than it is in reality. But it is, I think, an opportune moment to grab this momentum and to take the knowledge that you have about how your systems work in your countries and demand immediate change.
Okay, thank you so much.
Canadian law professor Kathleen Leahy, author of many publications on tax policy and gender, speaking on a panel at the Beijing Plus 20 ECE Regional Forum at the United Nations in Geneva in November 2014. The panel was recorded and excerpted by Wings series producer Frieda Worden. To hear this and other Wings programs again, or to ask for links to documents mentioned in the talks, email wings@wings.org, and please like our daily news feed at facebook.com/WingsRadio. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.